We met all day yesterday in a morning session, an afternoon session, and an evening session. This morning, we went on a tour with 36 members of the public to the plant, and those of you who are streaming or in attendance that want to go on that tour know that we do it all the time at our public meetings, and you can go the next time. We're reconvening this afternoon at the, this is the fourth and final session of our June public meeting. And the agenda this afternoon, the substance of the agenda is a couple of very interesting talks that we have actually requested to make sure that we're up to date on a couple of very important technical issues. The agenda is in front of you, but before we do this, I'd like to start just by introducing the members of the committee. Peter Lamb on my left, Per Peterson on my right, are members of the committee along with myself. On Per's right is Robert Wellington, who's the committee counsel. On his right is Furman Wardell, and on the far left is David Linen. Wardell and Linen are consultants to the committee, technical consultants with years of expertise in nuclear reactor safety. The first order of business here after reconvening is to ask whether any comments from the members. Any of us have any comment to make? Hearing none, the next order of business is public comment. I'll just read it because it's instructions. Anyone wishing to address the committee on matters not on the agenda may do so at this time. The public may comment on any matter listed on the agenda immediately following the time that the matter is considered by the committee. There will be a time limit of not more than 5 minutes for each speaker, and we don't promise we're going to take any action on anything that anybody says we might, but typically we'll think about it or refer it or do some more research or have our staff do further research, or we will ourselves. So now's the time where if anybody, a member of the public, wishes to make a public comment, you should identify yourself and make it, and you can do it now. And if not, go right ahead. And if not, then we'll move on to the agenda. Go ahead. You just have to say your name and where you're from. And you should know that it's on streaming on television on slow span, so you should at least know that that's what you're doing. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. my name is Greg Davis. I'm from Livermore, California. And I simply wanted to comment on the excellent tour and presentations that were given this morning to the
Thank
public.
You.
And I found it extremely informative and very useful. And I thought everyone...
These are my own questions and somebody else's too. Two questions from the presentation about the earthquake and tsunami yesterday. Dr. Budnitz, when talking about the fourth reactor, the spent fuel pool was filled with water, they discovered 5 weeks or so after the incident, and it was a mysterious, well, very strange as to why, how the roof blew off if it was full of water.
Yes, ma'am.
I had two questions about that. When you showed the slide and offered the possibility that steam from Unit 3 had transferred itself over to Unit 4.
Actually, it was hydrogen, we think, from Unit 3.
Well, okay. Oh, that makes a difference. Okay. All right. Hydrogen coming over then. The pipe was severed. So how did the hydrogen get over there?
We think it was severed during the large explosion.
Oh, during the roof blowing off?
In other words, it got over there, then there was the explosion, and then the pipe was severed. You could see the severed pipe in the picture.
But the severed pipe was way over by Unit 3.
Yes, but these explosions cause very big forces. By the way, it's worth saying, and this is people should understand, it looks like a very unusual or hard-to-conceive event that it happened. It looks very difficult to see that that's so. But no other explanation has come forth. And it is certainly more than possible that that happened. I'm fond of saying something to others that I'll just say here. Sherlock Holmes, somewhere along the line, I'll just sort of paraphrase, said, when you've eliminated all the impossibles, the really unlikely is probably it. That's not a joke. We don't know, but this seems, Per can perhaps elaborate, because he and I have been looking at this together.
Yeah.
It seems like that's the only explanation we can come up with.
But it does seem odd that severing would be way over by Unit 3.
Well, but there's some big forces. Go ahead, Pierce.
So the...
Yes.
Basically, we do know that Unit 3, when the fuel in the reactor vessel was damaged because it was uncovered for a prolonged period of time, released a substantial amount of hydrogen, some of which leaked into the Unit 3 building. People are still trying to understand why the vent system did not function properly to exhaust all the hydrogen to the outside. But most of the theories for that currently relate to the prolonged loss of the explosion that occurred in Unit 3 occurred 19 hours prior to the explosion that occurred in Unit 4, which meant that the hydrogen had to accumulate but then stay for a long period of time before finally having something happen to it. But the other potential source, which would be the spent fuel pool in Unit 4, the subsequent examination of that pool has shown that all the fuel elements appear to be intact, and the amount of radioactive material in the water is very small, which would argue against, and also it takes a very, very long period of time to actually boil off enough water to expose fuel. So we know that the pools have not been leaking because we've been able to refill them. They've been able to refill them, and they've not gone down in level at any significant rate beyond what you would get from just simple evaporation. So this is causing most people to lean towards the theory that the hydrogen must have come from Unit 3. I think that we will not be able to say conclusively what happened until after it's been possible to remove the fuel out of the Unit 4 pool and inspect it to see if there's any damage by oxidation or not. And that will pretty much conclusively say, no, it could not have come from the pool or through some mechanism it might have.
There's also some examination that is planned of that piping system to see what forces and what things that broke or didn't or how it happened could have produced that break, and infer if, or perhaps we can't infer, that perhaps those forces could have done that, or maybe they say, no, they couldn't have done that. It has to be some other explanation. Right. There's still a lot of what we call forensics to go, okay?
That leads to a second question.
Sure.
Why didn't the water boil off? Because was the water circulating in the pool?
So,
and if so, how?
That's a very good question. Unit 4 pool had by far the most heat load of any of the pools in that system, because it had fuel which had been freshly offloaded. And after fuel has been in a spent fuel pool for 12 months to 18 months, the heat generation rate has drops off enormously. So in that pool, the majority of heat was actually coming from that offloaded fuel. But immediately after the accident occurred, in the United States, there were serious efforts looking at. And the interesting characteristic was that the peak ground accelerations, even though it was magnitude 9, were not enormously large. They were actually, as best we can tell, and from inspections that have been performed on Daini 2, the other plant where we have very similar reactors, not substantive amount of seismic damage occurred, but the shaking was prolonged for a very long period of time. And spent fuel pools will slosh at a frequency with a period of about 4 seconds. So if you were to move, that's slow.
Kids in the bathtub.
Right.
And yeah.
Normally earthquakes don't have a lot of energy at those low frequencies.
Nor does it last that long.
Nor does it. But this one just went on and on and on for like 3 or 4
but
minutes.
But other motion. Pools lost water. Was it only by sloshing? I thought it boiled off.
In the end, what's happened is as they've refilled them, what they've found is that they're watertight. Or at least if there's leaks, the rates are so small that they would not have been an important mechanism for causing water.
I'm not thinking of leaks. I'm thinking of evaporation from boiling.
None of the other pools had fuel whose heat generation was nearly as high as the one in Unit 4.
But didn't they lose water by boiling?
And therefore, none of the others would have had heat generation enough to boil off enough. That's our current... Understand am I right? Think about that.
Because I thought it heated up right away. And the water in that, the fourth one.
Basically, it takes 1 to 2 days for it to heat up to temperatures where it is close enough to boiling that actually it will evaporate water But then subsequently, it takes a very long time to evaporate enough water to lower the level.
Well, except that is what happened with the others. The water was gone. The zirconium cladding was gone.
No.
So the hydrogen built up.
Not in the pools.
In the pools?
Correct.
As best we can tell right now, it does not appear that any of the fuel that was in the pools was damaged by becoming uncovered or losing water inventory.
Was the water in the fourth pool, was it circulating?
No, it just...
Okay, sitting there.
It evaporates a little bit, and therefore you ultimately must refill it, or else you will lose level.
And there wasn't any
refilling.
It
is our best understanding that in none of those pools did the water ever get to the point where uncovery and fuel damage occurred.
And it's not circulating, even though the water hasn't boiled off. Why it didn't boil off.
But what we know is that given the heat load, you can calculate how rapidly you would evaporate water away to remove the heat. And those calculations indicate that you have week, 2 weeks, long periods of time.
Boiling?
Boiling.
Yeah, yeah.
The amount of energy required to evaporate that volume of water turns out to be quite large.
Remember, there's 20-something feet of water above them. That's a lot of water.
Yeah, okay. I'm not satisfied, and I hope... I understand.
No one is on this particular issue.
Well, that's what I wanted to say. I hope you folks aren't satisfied either.
What I would tell you is that the reason that this uncertainty exists is because those pools did not have level instrumentation that could provide a direct measurement of the inventory of water, and instead indirect methods were used to determine how much water one might have. And so that was one of the things that contributed, and it's a lesson learned from this accident.
Another lesson.
Thank you.
My name's June Cochran. I'm from Shell Beach. I read the inspection reports from the NRC and see detailed information about ongoing and serious problems. The most common consequence for PG&E failures to meet NRC requirements is that they have to admit it and promise to put it into the corrective action program, often to provide more training. So we see this time after time, even in this meeting. Often the same exact problem pops up in the next inspection report and gets sent back to the CAP. There have been 11 NRC violations in the last four quarters, such as an adverse trend in problem identification and problem resolution. I'm going to repeat that because I think, there's been kind of an effort to downsize these violations. And I want to tell you that I don't think this is a minor violation. I'm sure you don't either. An adverse trend, that means ongoing, in problem identification and problem resolution, that does not seem to be going away anytime soon after hearing the words from different PG&E spokespersons yesterday indicating that another series of recent problems were due to the procedure was flawed, a guide enough, a lack of senior leadership providing oversight. You mentioned yesterday if something has a red designation, it's still operable. That is not good enough, nor is it in any way reassuring. It sounds like that's okay, we'll try to make it better, and that's not very reassuring to the public, and I know it's not reassuring to you as well. PG&E was supposed to get back to me to tell me if the fire protection system that we learned yesterday was vital in emergencies is now green or will ever be green, and how many years it has not been green, and I know that's been a long time. I know you do not want the public to hear such a statistic, PG&E, but it is sad that no one can find out that information in just a few hours. Committee member Budnitz indicated technology has increased 100-fold in the airplane industry, and there would be many more accidents if the technology had stayed the same. This is an old plant with aging parts that have corroded and caused a problem, as we have heard several times, including once more yesterday. The planes with the old technology might have still been operable, but all of them have been taken out of service, just as this aging nuclear power plant should be decommissioned. Committee member Peterson also used the same analogy with cars at one point a few years ago, saying that old cars still run, but new cars with airbags are much safer, just as nuclear plants are much safer now than they used to be. We realize new plants are cost prohibitive and are banned right now in California, so the industry and PG&E find it necessary to relicense aging plants because that's the only plant they're going to have in the near future. You asked how PG&E could regain our trust yesterday. The California Energy Commission and the state legislature have mandated that utilities in California produce 33% of electrical energy with renewable resources by 2020. If you go to the PG&E Center, they will tell you all about the advances they have made in renewables, including solar, wind, and wave. Since you've made all these advances and have that knowledge, then it would be easy to advance these technology on the existing grid you have out in Diablo Canyon while you begin decommissioning this plant. The public does not see a committed move in that direction, and we would like to.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? You should say your name and where you're from.
My name's Tom Schumann. I'm from San Luis, presumably rush into Santa Barbara, Fresno, Salinas, etc., and would be quite a chaotic situation. Thank you.
Any others? Yes. Yeah, just say your name and where you're from.
Yeah, Doug Whitney from San Francisco. I'm a consultant, a mixture of electronic systems and alternative energy. I would like to thank you for your efforts in the tour, and I was pleasantly impressed with the thoroughness of the operation in general. I did, as you might have inferred from my questions in the simulator on the software, find myself intrigued. I risk being redundant because I don't have a good long-range view of the committee's activities, but poking through the archives, perhaps deservedly, the mechanical, nuclear, and environmental aspects get a lot of attention. And that's mirrored in the backgrounds of the people involved. But I found myself wondering about, as I said, for example, software revision control in the simulator and phasing with the Westinghouse source software. And actually, I'm a hardware engineer, not a software engineer. But just wondering whether it might be a useful change of pace for a season to take a turn to go through the electronics, hardware, and software, and ask all sorts of little useful questions, like, for example, a major trend is that a working designer today minimizes, you can now stop using electrolytic capacitors in all kinds of places where you had to use them before. And guess what? The reliability of the system goes up. That's a nice little useful review of what might be found on either the hardware or the software side there. So that's my thought for the day.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments from the public? Anyone here want to comment about any of these comments? Yeah, I just have one on the last one, which is real simple. We have, in fact, over the years, and including recently, given considerable attention to the control system, instrumentation system at the plant, and the issue, which is not only at Diablo but around the country, of conversion from analog to digital, which has been an underway conversion process all throughout the industry and at Diablo. And we paid attention to the issues that impede more rapid use of at the next couple of fact-finding trips that we make to the plant. We'll certainly cover that topic because it remains a topic of great interest for us. Okay.
If I could take that a step further, yesterday I reported on the INC, Instrumentation and Control, obsolescence program that the station has. We've looked at this several times, and it's how they are, in a controlled and programmed way, replacing their analog and older instrumentation and controls with newer digital types, including software. And if you look at our reports on our website, or the report I made yesterday, you'll get a good idea of the program that they have. It's a pretty impressive program. I think it's industry-leading as far as the nuclear power industry goes. So there are write-ups about that. If you're interested, I can direct you to that later.
I could also describe some of the software upgrades and things they've done on the simulator as well to improve its fidelity in modeling plant transient response, including they, of course, simulate a number of different types of potential accidents so that the operators can train and be familiar with how to respond. So those upgrades have been substantial simply because computing power has improved enormously. But I think you do raise an important point, which is that the backgrounds of the people on the committee are mechanical and nuclear. And the issues associated with software and with electronic components are very important to the safety of the plant. So I think we try to do due diligence, but you raise a valid point.
Any others? Well, without further ado, we're going to move on to the agenda to the first presentation. I'm going to turn the proceedings over to Lauren Sharp, who will introduce himself and his position at the plant. And the next two presentations will be from PG&E. But as I said earlier, they're on here because we asked for them. These are things that are of great interest to us. And I'm eagerly looking forward to especially the first one. So, Lauren, you want to introduce the topic and the speaker?
So I'm Lauren Sharp, Senior Director of Technical Services. I guess I might add just one comment on the digital conversion. We have done, as been mentioned, a lot of upgrades to digital and the balance of plant systems, but we are a pilot plant on some of the digital upgrades.
As well as the whole analog to digital issue.
That's a very helpful comment. And I know that they are, Lauren said, or Furman said, in the industry, PG&E's plant here has been one of the leading plants that are trying to do this ahead of the others, and their experience will then inform a whole lot that's going on elsewhere in the industry. So that's a nice sort of accolade for them and apparently deserved.
I think, for example, the addition of one of the first digital control systems that was added to the plant was for feed water control to the steam generators, like Eagle 21.
Which is a vital system.
And that's been subsequently replaced with new digital systems because they have been evolving enormously. But as was mentioned, putting a new digital control system into a nuclear power plant requires an enormous amount of effort to verify that it will function properly under a wide variety of conditions. And so these are not changes that are taken lightly or done rapidly.
And as always, we worry about cybersecurity. We have to demonstrate that as well. So there's just many, many more challenges in that conversion. We're still making progress and are well on our way, but we still have to work our way through those. So I did want to make that comment. Anyway, for the next session, it'll be done by Bill Guldeman. He is a special assistant out to Jim Becker, the site vice president, and I'll let Bill take over from here.
As Lauren indicated, my name is Bill Guldeman. I am a special assistant to the site vice president. I'm also responsible for the Fukushima response team activities at Diablo Canyon. First presentation I'm making today is a comparative design review of Diablo Canyon to boiling water reactor. It's a fairly concise presentation, but I want to point out some of the salient design features at Diablo Canyon.
Excuse me, Bill. Can you turn the volume up, please?
I'll try. I'll do my best. Right.
His normal rate is this is his slow rate. And I want to say this in the fondest way because we love the guy.
Please, slowly as possible.
I'll try to slow down.
But get through it.
Understand, proceed efficiently through the presentation.
Okay.
Let's start by talking about the design of the Diablo Canyon plant. Diablo is the steam that flows out from the containment to the turbine and circulates through the balance of plant is not radioactive. There's an intermediate loop in the form of the reactor coolant system that transfers the heat. The plants are served each with a large dry containment. There are about 2.6 million cubic feet The containments are serviced with containment spray system, which will spray water, borated water, into the containment in the event of an accident to suppress any pressure surge from either a reactor coolant system leak or from a secondary break. They are also equipped with internal hydrogen recombiners. Those hydrogen recombiners do require electrical power, but they can be used to control the hydrogen and combustible gas concentrations in containment. Decay heat following a reactor shutdown is typically removed through the steam generators to the condenser or to the atmosphere. Key point, again, is that processing the steam is not radioactive as a result of heat transfer through the steam generators. Emergency feed water is supplied by the auxiliary feed water pumps. There are two kinds of pumps. One kind of pump, or two of them, are motor-driven. The second kind is turbine-driven. Steam is taken from two steam generators, up to two steam generators, passed to the turbine on the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump, driving the turbine and causing the pump to rotate. Suction is supplied to the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump from the condensate storage tank. It's a safety-related supply of water and provided to the steam generators for continued decay removal. I would note that the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump can be operated without the benefit of any electrical power. AC power is not required for decay removal through the steam generators, as I indicated, using the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump. That pump will operate for a protracted period of time to steam pressures down to the vicinity of about 150 pounds. We do as well have the capability, should the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump or the aux feed water system not be available, to remove decay heat by primary feed and bleed to containment that's putting water into the reactor coolant system and intentionally venting water from the reactor coolant system. But that method is only available if AC power is available to support RCS makeup.
Bill, could I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Your emergency feed water pump has the steam-driven turbine pump.
Correct.
And so as water is supplied to the steam generators, it creates steam, which comes back, which removes heat, which comes back, and that same steam drives the pump.
Correct. Right,
feed and bleed. As decay heat diminishes over time, how long can you keep this up?
Talking days, at least.
Yeah. Now, let me play this back. You're in a blackout, and the auxiliary feed water pump is running on the steam.
Correct.
And the question was asked, how long that'll last before the steam is no longer, because it's not hot enough? That part is weeks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it depends on whether or not we cool down the plant. If we choose to just maintain hot standby.
That's what I meant. If you're just maintaining hot standby, that part is weeks.
It can I don't know exactly how long it is.
I don't remember exactly, but it's not days.
It's more than a couple of days.
That's right. Yes. It's not days.
Could you have additional mechanisms for getting water into steam generators besides the turbine-driven pump at this point? Right?
Well, we do have emergency means. I mean, we've got ways of getting water into the steam generator, make up water to the auxiliary feed water pumps from our raw water reservoirs up on the hill. We have the capability of providing water actually from the ocean or from the aux salt water system into the condensate storage tank or directly to the auxiliary feed water pumps. And we also have the capability, when steam pressure drops low enough, to use temporary pumps, including fire water pumps or a fire truck, to pump water through the feed water system or the aux feed water system into the steam generators.
So then the question comes, let's remember at Fukushima, that how they got in trouble was they had a blackout. They didn't have any grid, and they didn't have any on-site AC power. And in Unit 2, for example, the reactor core isolation cooling system, which runs on steam, mm-hmm. ran for a while, then it failed. And the failure apparently was because the control system failed, although we're not completely sure of this, because of battery depletion. So it's a vital question to ask whether at Diablo and other plants like it, whether if you got into a blackout, whether that steam-driven aux feed pump is going to run for weeks. We were talking now about capacity of the steam, but are there other things that it depends on? For example, control systems that run on batteries that are going to get depleted?
It can be operated manually and controlled manually without the benefit of AC power.
I thought that was
power.
True too, but I wanted to hear you say that.
Yes.
So therefore, unlike at Fukushima, it's not dependent on DC batteries.
That's correct. Okay. Now, the other thing that likely caused a problem at Fukushima is that the Rixie turbine exhausts into the Taurus. causing a heat up of the torus. There was the inability to remove heat from the torus, and so eventually you're going to reach saturated conditions.
And it was taking suction from that same torus.
Correct. Correct. The auxiliary feed water supply, makeup water supply, is from a tank that does not receive steam from the auxiliary feed water pump. The auxiliary feed water pump, turbine-driven exhaust atmosphere.
But one of those, Rixie, okay. Your system does not rely on that battery power.
That's correct.
And your system doesn't take suction from a torus that could get so hot it would boil.
Correct.
I think that the key differentiation with the PWR is that you can reject the heat out into the environment, and so you don't heat up, you don't deposit the energy inside containment and heat up containment. In a boiling water reactor, of necessity, because it's water that's being boiled in the reactor, the steam is condensed inside the containment in this pool of water, and over time it becomes saturated and it doesn't serve as effective right. heat sink.
Certainly without the benefit of torus cooling. That's the situation that you're in. That's right.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Bill, the aux feed water pump takes suction from the condensate?
Typically the condensate storage tank.
Now, and so the volume of that tank?
200,000 gallons.
And so that
It's sized. If you start out with a full condensate storage tank, the basis for the size is to remain in hot standby, depending upon the unit, either 1 or 2 hours, and then do a cool down. To RHR entry conditions at either 25 or 50 degrees per hour. There's sufficient water to take you down to the RHR entry conditions if you have AC power available. We also have makeup capability from various sources. The source of makeup depends on whether or not you have alternating current power or AC power, but we can make up from the condenser. We can make up from the demineralized water system, from the fire protection system. We can install temporary pumps and pump water into the condensate storage tank or fire water storage tank to supply okay. additional
That's what
water
I was getting at, because that tank will get depleted.
It will.
And so, but there are sources that could be used depending on whether you have AC power to do it just with hard pipe systems or portable if you needed to.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, for the continuing on, the RCS makeup is from the charging system, the charging injection system, safety injection, or low pressure injection. All of those systems do require AC power. The plant is equipped with one accumulator, passive accumulator per loop, four accumulators total per unit. Those have a nitrogen overpressure, and they will inject when RCS pressure drops below about 600 pounds. The next bullet up there, I apologize, is misworded. The spent fuel is stored in the fuel handling building. We have proceduralized emergency makeup capability from multiple sources, or it's stored dry storage at the independent spent fuel storage installation. Diablo Canyon, as I mentioned last night, repeat again here, is equipped with three emergency diesel generators per unit with cross-tie capability to the other unit. What the various instruments and controls, we do have two and a half million gallon freshwater reservoirs up in the vicinity of the independent spent fuel storage installation. There's lines that come down to the plant. Yes?
Today on the tour, one of those reservoirs was empty while they were cleaning it.
Yeah, we do. We do pretty
this happens from time to time.
Yes.
But there's always one.
Correct. The plants, both plants are equipped with automatic trips on seismic events of the appropriate magnitude.
Bill, could I ask you on your emergency diesel generators? I know they use compressed air to start.
Correct.
So no electric power there needed. Can you manually start those generators without DC control power?
We can. We have a procedure for doing that. It does require that we block open the field flash relay. We rely on residual magnetism. We can line up the system and manually start it, provided we have sufficient pressure in the starting air and turbo air receivers. They will bleed down over about a 10-hour period to the point where it may become problematic. We're currently working on a design for a backup diesel-driven air compressor that could be brought in to repressurize those starting air receivers should it become necessary.
Okay, thank you.
So if you started to lose the air pressure that would be necessary to start those, you could in fact start them, and then they'd be running because it's only the start that matters. And then the only reason why you wouldn't do that early is you might be worried about running out of fuel.
Well, we've got a 7-day supply of fuel for each
unit. But I mean, that would be the only reason why you'd say, gee, we're starting to run out of air. Let's start the diesels.
We could certainly do that.
Huh?
That's right. But, yeah, you're right. We could do that. We can't
rather than say, gee, we've run out of air, and now
we
need them.
Now we find ourselves. I mean, there are other techniques that can be used, including the use of compressed gases. Yeah. You know, because that air doesn't provide combustion air directly. So you could use nitrogen, you could use compressor air to charge those receivers from cylinders as well. So there are a variety of ways, but right now we are working on getting a diesel compressor to provide air to at least one of the diesels so we can start it and restore electrical power.
Great.
Could you also discuss the capacity of the battery system and reviews to determine whether it might need to be augmented?
I don't have the exact numbers. My recollection is somewhere on the order of between 6 and 8 hours of battery capacity. That's one of the things that we do need to consider in a prolonged station blackout is that you do lose indication if you do lose your DC power. We've got some work to do in that regard.
I'll put an additional burden to the DC power system. Now, it turned out that illumination may be necessary for personnel to get around the plant on one hand, but it creates a draining on the battery system on the other hand. And in the context of that discussion, and it turned out the battery system, the DC battery system, may not last the 6 to 8 hours that you just indicated.
A couple of comments. I'll have to confirm this, but my recollection is the lighting system, by and large, is provided with its own batteries. But I've got to confirm that. I have to confirm that. Beyond that, if you get into a station blackout event, after you start reducing primary system pressure and steam generator pressure, cooling down the plant to the point where you can put the accumulators in service for RCS makeup, there's a series of steps that are built into the procedure to intentionally reduce the load on the batteries to prolong battery life. And there's a series of loads that are intentionally stripped off the batteries to prolong the life of the batteries.
Mm-hmm. And another related question is, would you please elaborate a little bit more on the interaction of some of the vital safety equipment, such as oxygen water system, and its dependency, and the diesel generator, and their dependency on both DC power, emergency power, and the air system, and maybe the system that supports some other system. You know, there are numerous systems, they are interconnected. And also, if I remember correctly, the NRC had done an air system failure and consequences for the industry about 25 years ago. And I think that particular study actually was done under my supervision, had indicated there are a lot of nuances. And each plant had different design, and it may go down to the level or detail of maybe a valve here, a condensate trap here, air filter here and there that could potentially disable the entire system. Little things here and there. Now, I am not knowledgeable enough about how your air system and the DC battery system and this charging system, it's interrelated, support system interact or what even
potential heat removal capability. We can continue to feed the steam generators absent both DC power and air. It does require some manual action to do that, but it can be done without those two motive sources of power.
So are you saying without air, I mean compressed air, and without DC power, the AFW would not work?
I'm saying the opposite. With operator action, local operator action, we can open the atmospheric dump valves, 10% dump valves, uh-huh, to bleed steam to the atmosphere. We can manually control feed flow to the steam generators, and we can manually control the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump.
Right. So that is with the assistance of local manual.
That's correct.
Operation.
That's correct.
Okay. And I would assume all these area has been well identified and procedure been developed. You know exactly where and when to send people down there and to do what.
We know where the operators have to be and the equipment that they have to operate, and that's procedurally specified.
Uh-huh. And were there consideration given to accessibility? Could this equipment be accessed either debris, obstruction, or high radioactive level or some other consideration, such as, you know, if your fire protection system come on, I don't, you know, if, could it be carbon dioxide, could it be some other material for fire extinguishing that would prevent access, or could it be a door that would be locked and has an interlock but not be open in time? Are these some of the ongoing
the many of the areas are readily accessible. Now, obviously, if it's a core damaging event, don't know exactly. Depends upon the extent of core damage, the level of radiation, and whether or not that would permit access. Those calculations have not been run consistently throughout the plant in order to be able to demonstrate under all core damaging events that you could get to some of this equipment. But in general, most of it is accessible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. You know, it is hard because, you know, who knows what the numerous possible combination would be.
Correct. Okay, this is a diagram of the Diablo Canyon containment. It happens to be in north-south view. You can see where the reactor sits in the lower part of the containment. Forgive me, I'm going to use my little laser pointer here, and I understand this is for the benefit of the people sitting here in the room. The reactor sits in the lower part of the control, and combustible gas control becomes more problematic in a BWR containment than in a PWR containment. I think those are the key points I wanted to make there. The Fukushima design, they have six General Electric boiling water reactors. Units 1 through 4 are equipped with Mark 1 containments, and I'll show you a picture here in a minute of a Mark 1 containment. The Mark 1 containment has a dry well area, which contains the reactor, and then a torus, which is a circular donut-looking structure that communicates with the dry well through downcomers. And in the event of an accident in the BWR where steam is released to the dry well, it flows through the downcomers into the torus where it's condensed to control the pressure in the dry well. The containments are equipped with a hard pipe vent system to vent containment. That would be done for pressure control should pressure rise too high in a post-accident environment. Some of that was seen in the case of, at Fukushima. And it can be also used to remove decay heat removal, to remove decay heat from the torus or from the containment directly to atmosphere under extremist conditions, and for combustible gas control, you can vent the containment to either reduce the hydrogen concentration. I would note that the containments on the Mark I containments, the boiling water reactor containments, are typically inerted, and what that means is the atmosphere in the containments during operation is nitrogen atmosphere to prevent any ignition of any accumulation of hydrogen in a post-accident environment. Decay removal is typically performed in a boiling water reactor by steaming reactor coolant to the main condenser. The main condenser to do that requires AC power. That was not possible in the case of Fukushima. One of the units of Fukushima was equipped with an isolation condenser, which is basically a condenser that on the secondary side has water in it that can be steamed off as you admit steam from the reactor to this condenser. Since it stays basically at the same pressure as the reactor coolant system, it's a passive system. Water can go back into the reactor coolant system. Only one of the units was equipped with an isolation condenser. You can steam to the torus through the safety relief valves. You can vent containment to the atmosphere, or you can run the reactor core isolation cooling system, which was done on units two and three. The reactor core isolation cooling system is an analog to the auxiliary feed water system at a pressurized water reactor insofar as you take steam, you run a turbine. The turbine provides makeup water, in this case to the reactor as opposed to the steam generators. But because the steam is radioactive, it's not released to atmosphere like it is in a turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump at a PW. One that is not readily operable without normal control power. The reactor core isolation cooling system, which I talked about, which is turbine, and again, if the system is equipped that way, the Japanese managed to keep at least that system going for several days on one of the units, and that whole scenario was not fully understood, so I'm not going to speculate as to how they were successful or how they were not successful. The reactors are equipped with core spray systems, which are motor-driven injection systems, and a control rod drive cooling system, which is a small capacity system, which does supply water to the RCS during normal makeup and can be used to provide makeup water under extremist conditions if you have alternating current power. Spent fuel is stored in a pool in the reactor building adjacent to the reactor at a very high elevation, complicating efforts to add makeup water to the spent fuel pool should that be necessary. In the case of the units 1 through 4, emergency power was provided by 2 emergency generators per unit. Those emergency generators were lost due to the tsunami. Like the Diablo Canyon, they had battery backup to various instruments and controls. Their diesel generator, switch gear, and batteries were all below grade and therefore susceptible to inundation. And their reactors, likewise, are equipped with automatic trips in response to a seismic event. This is a cutaway view of a typical boiling water reactor with a Mark I containment. The reactor is this red vessel that's sitting in here. You can see various steam and feed water lines coming off. The primary containment boundary is what is inside. What is yellow on this diagram, the yellow is concrete. The dry well is a steel-lined pressure vessel. I talked earlier about downcomers. These are the downcomers that do communicate with the dry well when pressure goes up in the dry well in a in an accident environment. Valves will open, allowing steam to flow through these downcomers into this piping that you see here with the spargers that go down below water level, and the water that is in the torus is used to suppress the pressure in the dry well. The torus is equipped with a cooling system that ultimately ties to the ultimate heat sink, but that cooling system functions only if there is AC power that is available. The reactor core isolation cooling system can take suction from the torus at many plants. I'm not sure about Fukushima. It can also take a suction from the condensate storage tank, which is typically not seismically qualified. The steam from the reactor core isolation cooling system is returned to or is exhausted into the torus for suppression purposes. The pressure does rise. The reactor building that were destroyed in the explosions on units 1, 3, and 4 were primarily the metal portions. Here, the remainder of the building is a seismically qualified concrete building. The emergency core cooling systems are located in corner rooms in the 4 quadrants of the reactor building.
Bill, you've got the reactor building listed as secondary containment at the top left.
That is correct.
It is a containment building.
It is a containment building. It is equipped with a standby gas treatment system. The building is normally maintained or normally capable of being maintained at a slight negative pressure. The standby gas treatment system does take a suction on the reactor building, and it does discharge through charcoal filters to the atmosphere. So the building does serve as a containment structure, much like the auxiliary building at a pressurized water reactor serves as a containment for the potential contaminated fluids that would be recirculated during an accident at a pressurized water reactor.
But it's nowhere as strong as a containment as far as pressure goes.
No, it is not built for significant positive pressure like the primary containment is.
Right.
It's more of a confinement system, if you will.
Right, okay. The spent fuel pool there, it does have cooling, right?
It does. There is a spent fuel pool cooling system and a purification system, heat exchangers and so forth. I didn't mean to imply that there wasn't.
No, I just
but again, you've got to have alternating current power. But one of the points I was trying to make is that the relative elevation is such that it becomes problematic in terms of providing gravity makeup and such.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Can they also use the standby liquid control system to do reactor makeup?
Yes, but they need AC power.
Yeah, you will need AC power for the standby liquid control system, and the capacity for the standby liquid control is very low. I mean, its principal purpose is to inject highly borated water to suppress the nuclear reaction in the event that you have a return to criticality for some reason or you have a failure to scram.
Yeah, I think the capacity is 10 or 20% of HPSIS, maybe.
I would guess it's been long enough. I've been away from them long enough that I don't recollect the numbers. I'll just leave it at
10% of HPSIS.
It may be. Yeah, I think it would be.
Not even be safety grade.
No.
I believe it is safety grade
because it has to inject boron for criticality control, and that's safety grade.
That's right.
Yes, it's just a question. Its capacity is pretty low.
Oh, but 10% of HPSIS is tremendous.
Yeah, but I think it's gallons per minute as opposed to 100.
It is?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's relatively low. High-pressure core spray. There's two systems, two different designs on boiling water reactors. One is a high-pressure core spray system. The other is a high-pressure coolant injection. Most of the reactors,
relative to the other technology in that regard, because they had multiple means of injecting water in the reactor vessel at high pressure.
It certainly is true, but they need AC power. Yeah.
Any further questions on this diagram? Hearing none. This is a duplicate of a slide that we talked about last night, but I did want to talk a little bit about the licensing and design basis for seismic and tsunami, and this is just a compare and contrast. Fukushima was originally licensed for a ground acceleration of 0.36 G. That was upgraded subsequently to about 0.6. The earthquake that occurred, the foundation acceleration, and some of these numbers were tossed about earlier, so forgive me if I'm being repetitive, was between 0.3 and 0.5 G. So the foundation acceleration, which is the building acceleration, was marginally in alignment with the design basis of the plant. The free ground acceleration in some cases exceeded the design basis. Diablo Canyon, by comparison, the ground acceleration design basis is 0.75 G, which is substantially higher. But obviously that's a plant-unique number that varies from plant to plant in the United States and around the world. The tsunami wave height assumed at Fukushima was approximately 21 feet. The actual tsunami wave height was as high as almost 50 feet. Diablo Canyon assumes a wave height of 35 feet, which is less than what was experienced at Fukushima. You want to go on to the next slide, please? Okay, what kind of conclusions do we reach based upon the comparison? Well, Diablo Canyon can conduct protracted decay heat removal without AC power, principally through steaming the steam generators and making up to the steam generators using the auxiliary feed water system. The emergency power system at Diablo Canyon is more robust. It's located at a higher level above the ocean, so less subject to inundation. I'm sorry, the question?
I was going to go back to that first bullet amount.
Yeah.
Is it correct to say that they could operate without AC or DC power? Didn't I hear you say that earlier?
We can operate the auxiliary water system without DC power. The key point I wanted to make was that we didn't require access to the ultimate heat sink for some period of time, which requires AC power.
All right.
But this, and again, this is for decay heat removal.
Yes.
Can we then go back to what you just indicated earlier when you and I were having a discussion? Mm-hmm. Can we also say without DC
generator pressures? And I believe flow rates can be measured. We have handheld instrumentation that can be used to measure flow rates.
So he need at least three indications. The flow rate when you throttle the outlet and steam generator level and pressure.
Correct. The emergency power system at Diablo Canyon, the electrical distribution system, as I indicated, are less susceptible to inundation by a tsunami. They're at a higher elevation. The larger containments at the pressurized water reactors generally, but Diablo Canyon specifically, less susceptible to the buildup of pressure. We're not releasing reactor coolant into the containment as a means of decay heat removal, mm-hmm. At least assuming that we've got the steam generators and auxiliary feed water available. Decay heat is, in fact, dissipated outside containment as opposed to inside containment like it was at the boiling water reactors.
There's also the question of how hydrogen is managed and the differences between the boiling water reactors and the PWRs. Could you discuss that since that's...
On the next slide.
Oh,
well, our containments are equipped with hydrogen recombiner capability.
I'm getting ahead of your slides. Go right ahead, please.
That's quite all right. There's another, I don't mean to sound like I'm throwing boiling water reactors under the bus, so forgive me, but there's another vulnerability at a boiling water reactor where you are releasing steam from the reactor coolant system either directly into containment or into the torus, and that is if there has been any fuel damage, if there has been any hydrogen accumulation in the reactor coolant system, it will be vented into the containment. Now, the containment is supposed to be inerted, right? And as long as it remains inerted, you're all right. But if you are injecting water, air-saturated water, from outside the containment into the containment, you can build up oxygen, which can ignite with the hydrogen that's present. Alternatively, the hydrogen can leak out of containment and find its way into other locations in the plant, which we believe to have occurred at Fukushima.
When you say that the slide notes that you need to have electrical power for the recombiners, is that AC power, DC power?
AC power.
AC power.
Now,
these are spark igniters, or is it?
I believe they are spark igniters.
That's not a lot.
Heaters.
But okay. There remains the question, and I'm not going to talk
heaters
about
for the catalytic converters?
Right, they're, okay. they're catalytic, not sparks.
I'm thinking of another point.
Excuse me. There remains the question about what the capacity is of those catalytic converters for hydrogen per minute or per hour, depending on how big. We haven't looked at that, and we ought to put that on our list here to examine.
I think Furman's got that on
just
his list.
Just to ask the question, and maybe a simple answer, as to what the capacity is per minute, let's say, for hydrogen from those recombiners.
Is that something that you'd like me to provide some information to the committee?
It would be very helpful. It's probably a very easy thing. I could go look it up in the SAR myself. It just occurred to me that I haven't.
I will take an action.
Because it's a simple thing to look up. And see whether there's got to be somewhere in the SAR where there's perhaps a page in which it describes what the assumption is about the accident that it's managing and what those rates are designed for, and we can see whether that makes sense.
So just to expand on the requested information, it's the design basis of the hydrogen recombiners and their capacity. I'll find that information.
I could find it in the SAR too, but one of us will find it. It's worth just not letting it go without an inquiry. Okay.
And quite candidly, management of combustible gases is one of the focus areas that is one of the lessons learned coming out of Fukushima. So there'll be more dialogue.
As it was at Three Mile Island. As everybody remembers, there was a deflagration at Three Mile Island,
that's right,
which led to all of that work, the IDCOR work and the NRC severe accident work, that led to that rule in the beginning, in the middle 80s.
Yeah. Okay. I think that the effects of the hydrogen explosions were... It greatly degraded their capability to respond. For example, they had established and hooked up a backup diesel generator to Unit 2 and were supplying power back into Unit 2 at the time that the Unit 1 explosion occurred. It severed the cable, and that was it for the power for a very long period of time.
There were a variety of implications of the hydrogen accumulation explosions. That was one I was not familiar with
We learned that about a week ago, what he just said.
But also a substantial loss of secondary containment capability. Even though the standby gas treatment system wasn't running at any of the plants because there wasn't any alternating current power, there was still some confinement capability in those buildings. That may have been able to limit the release to some extent.
The thing that Per just mentioned is an interaction between Fukushima Units 1 and 2. I wouldn't be a bit surprised as we learn more, as the Japanese, finally get access and learn a lot, about other places where adverse interactions from one of the units affected another unit that wouldn't have been true had there not been the multiple units. This was one example.
Pool cooling and restoration of AC power is one of the key lessons learned that is coming out of the event at Fukushima. And as I indicated last night, we are in the process of procuring a backup cooling water system for installation in the event that our auxiliary salt water system is compromised.
Yeah.
So that really completes my presentation. Questions.
Just one other comment. The comment I just made about Fukushima comes back to asking a question that I'm sure you're going to ask, and you better believe we're going to ask, and that is, whether, because of the configuration out there at your station, there are other places where something that might happen at one unit could, unbeknownst or at the moment, compromise something next door that we haven't completely thought through. I hope not, but it's worth some thorough evaluation just to give ourselves the extra assurance again, based on what we learned.
In general, the NRC has rather strong licensing requirements with regard to shared systems and the vulnerabilities they introduce. I'm not prepared to speak authoritatively on that exact configuration. Nothing at Diablo Canyon occurs to me off the top of my head, but I'm not going to try to speak authoritatively.
I wasn't sitting here accusing anybody of anything. I understand the regulations are clear, and their implications are that there's supposed to be enough of separation and redundancy and so on. But it's obvious that one of the repercussions of the accident in Japan is that we're all going to be looking more carefully to reaffirm, if so, that those things are so. And we all hope they are, and if they aren't, we're going to try to find them.
And that's one of the key learnings coming out of Fukushima, that unlike some of the assumptions that have been made in the past regarding single-unit-only events, particularly for external events and natural phenomena, there are some vulnerabilities that need to be thought through. questions?
May I ask you a couple of questions?
Absolutely.
Would you please go over how do you do primary feed and bleed?
It could be done a number of ways, but normally it would be done with a high pressure safety injection pump, charging into the reactor coolant system, and opening the reactor coolant system head vent. Coolant system head vent, or it could also be done with a power operated relief valve, but typically RCS head vent, to produce a nominal amount of flow through the reactor coolant system to assure continued cooling.
Is PORV the preference here?
I'd have to go back and look at the procedures. Uh-huh. My recollection from where I was licensed previously, which is not Diablo Canyon, was a reactor coolant system head vent.
That's the head vent. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but I thought you earlier mentioned it needs compressed air to open. Not.
You need solenoids to allow the air to cause the valve to open.
Oh, I see. So the solenoid valve is DC control. So it is
DC control, but air actuated.
Right, that's right.
So there are the two systems that you need. You need DC power to the solenoid, and then you need the air.
And I also need the AC power in order to be able to run the pumps to inject water into the reactor coolant system.
Okay. The second question is, now there is a capability to vent the containment. Can you describe how that can be accomplished?
We have normal containment vent capability. I'm not familiar with the capability under extremist conditions.
I didn't know that that was true. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I'm asking. You know,
you have to have the ability to vent the containment because you pressure test it every 10 years and drive it up to its design pressure, and then you have to, of course, relieve the pressure.
You do. The question is under extremist conditions, and I'm not familiar with. We do have a procedure that provides a methodology for doing it. I am not familiar with the content of that procedure.
So probably they're interlocked somewhere. You need to bypass something in order to accomplish.
That would be speculation on my part.
Sure. Okay. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can follow. If you have a desire for me to follow up with you on that, I can do that.
That's okay.
So, Bill, in your conclusions and what I've heard you say is, you've got days, if not weeks, of removing decay heat without AC or DC power, with some manual operation. That takes care of the fuel in the reactor and the spent fuel pool. And of course, that cooling is AC powered.
Correct.
You know, recirculation cooling. However, if you lose that, you've got a long period of time before boiling even commences, days or weeks, depending on the heat load.
Depending upon the heat load.
Now, if for some reason you couldn't restore power, have you got procedures and equipment in place to replenish water that may be boiling off of that pool?
We do. And as a matter of fact, my next presentation is going to talk about categories of procedures and provide examples. But we do have multiple means, gravity makeup. We can use from the RWST or from our demineralized water system, fire water, fire truck. We've got a variety of ways of getting
good. Equipment's in place that could be moved over to do that, and procedures are in place. Okay,
that's great.
Thank you.
Good. So the next presentation is going to have a narrow scope, it's a direct follow on to a piece of this. So
it is.
You want to go straight to it?
We can.
Is that okay?
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
Yes.
Operator training is provided on the emergency damage or the extreme damage mitigation procedures, which would include these manual operations. It's initial operator training. We're revisiting the frequency of that training as we speak.
Okay. I'm Sherry Lewis, by the way. Forgot to say. The nitrogen that is in a containment, in the boiling water one, which containment, the yellow one or the green one?
The yellow one, which is the dry well, is full of nitrogen rather than air.
And how did explosion? The explosion didn't happen inside
it happened outside the green one.
Secondary containment building.
Right, okay.
And then exploded.
About the tsunami at Diablo Canyon, talking about 85 feet. In the talk about the tsunami in Japan, parts of the tsunami went up 100 feet, you were saying, yesterday.
No, not on that site, but go ahead. But there were places where it was that high.
Right.
There are places along the coast in Japan where the orientation of the coast and of the subsurface of the run-up in the sea caused particularly higher tsunami than the rest of the coast.
Right.
And there were places.
It's conceivable here as well.
I didn't say that.
I'm saying it. I'm asking.
Okay, well, you can ask that. I don't know the answer because I'm not a tsunami expert. But there, I showed a figure yesterday where there were places along the coast where the tsunami height ran over 30 meters, and that's about 100 feet. Okay. Now, that's a particular configuration of the shape of the coastline and of the the slope of the near shore.
Right.
It is our understanding that those particular circumstances are not true at Diablo.
Okay.
I mean, I believe that's now the way you can read about that is there's a whole tsunami analysis in the safety analysis report for this plant, and that analysis confirms that's not that particular situation is not true here.
Is that on your website?
No, it's not.
I think that we can get you references to that. Plus, there's a probabilistic tsunami
hazard
report
okay. That
is available and ongoing studies on that topic. With respect to tsunamis, the one important when you're up through Alaska.
No. Of the seismic thing, the faults that we have here, I thought a couple of them were. No, most of them are strike slip, but there were a couple that were the thrust fault as well.
I had not heard that, but that would be the reason that you could still have tsunamis is that you can also generate tsunamis from underwater landslides, mm-hmm. and those can be localized. So probabilities are significantly lower. This leads us then to look at sort of what happens as you go beyond design basis with tsunamis here at this plant. And the first thing that would happen is that clearly the most vulnerable system from a tsunami standpoint is the auxiliary saltwater system. And the plant is capable of shutting down and removing decay heat in a stable way forever almost without the aux saltwater, although the portable equipment that is being procured and that had already been identified so it could be transported to the site will have the capacity to restore aux saltwater function within a relatively short period of time if the aux saltwater system were damaged. If you were to then generate a station blackout by also disabling the diesel generators, one still has the capacity to remove decay heat using turbine-driven aux feed water pumps. And if those should fail, then one has the capacity to remove decay heat using the portable equipment for injection. So
I thought he probably is going to talk about that in his next presentation.
Actually, that may
though.
Be the case. So, but at any rate, there's
because I had a question about that, but I thought I'd hear it first.
Right. Yeah. The vulnerability to severe earthquakes and tsunamis and the level of preparation to cope with them are better here than was the case at Fukushima.
Okay. And my last quick one is the examples of one unit affecting another unit. Mm-hmm. Do cross ties, which I heard about yesterday, not knowing particularly what they are, do cross ties between units make this better or worse?
Oh, it makes it better because without them, if you got in trouble in unit one, let's say, you couldn't bring over power or water or something from Unit 2, but with the cross-tie capability, you could.
Okay.
Now, go back to the fault. It is my understanding, having looked at it carefully, that none of the faults offshore here are thrust faults.
All the rest of the strike-slip faults or hanging wall faults that we have down here are really what you would call strike-slip faults.
Yeah, that was our understanding, too. Now, if you can...
Well, but thrust and subduction aren't the same thing.
We're not.
And you mentioned you said subduction. I'm not claiming there's subduction fault here.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say this again. If you have any evidence that you can point to us or a report that there's some faulting system around here that isn't a strike slip fault, we'd love to see it because
okay.
it's our understanding. Lauren, it's his understanding too. But he's not a seismologist, and I'm not a seismologist.
No, I went to that earthquake workshop, and
yeah, I'm not arguing the case.
Yeah. Okay.
It's my understanding that there are no thrust faults that provide any hazard to Diablo Canyon.
Okay.
That they're all strike slip faults.
No. The only other thing I would mention,
best I understood it.
With respect to tsunamis, is that
one also needs to be thinking about the other consequences, tsunamis, that you would expect if you had beyond design basis. And this leads us back to the importance of improving the tsunami warning system in California and north of California, because, of course, you have many, many people who live at lower elevations around here, and you wouldn't want to replicate the consequences that you saw in Japan here in California from the direct impact of a tsunami. So I think that there's a lot of work for us to be doing, and more generally in upgrading our infrastructure with respect to seismic and tsunami hazards in California and north of California.
Lauren? Bill? Next presentation.
So Bill, prepare the next presentation as well.
The next presentation is on the procedures and implementing organizations at Diablo Canyon. It was a presentation that was requested by the committee. If we could go ahead, the regulatory framework regarding procedures and operating the plants really exists in two areas. The first is 10 CFR 50 Appendix B Criterion 5 that requires activities affecting quality be prescribed by and accomplished in accordance with appropriate documented instructions, procedures, or drawings. And most of the procedures at Diablo Canyon fall into this category and are subject to these requirements. Beyond that, however, there are provisions in the Code of Federal Regulations for taking actions which are really outside Appendix Bravo under extremist conditions. In particular, 10 CFR 5054 X and Y specify that reasonable action that departs from a license condition or technical specification may be taken external actions to protect public health and safety. Now, I'm excluding a lot of the administrative procedures and those kinds of things. We're focusing on those things that surround managing plant configuration under normal and upset conditions. The types of procedures that we have for managing or supporting the plant are normal operating procedures, and I'll provide some detailed examples of each of these procedures as we get into the presentation. Enunciator response procedures, abnormal operating procedures, emergency operating procedures, functional recovery guidelines. All of those above are subject to Appendix Bravo type requirements. Beyond those, we get into the severe accident management guidelines and the extreme damage mitigation guidelines, and those typically require the invocation of 10 CFR 5054X because they do provide guidance on actions that are beyond design basis and maybe outside technical specification or license conditions. The casualty procedures are, you'll see what those are. They typically deal with external events and provide general direction for plant response to external events or fires. Procedures that talk about external actions principally fall into the category of emergency plan implementing procedures that would direct activities looking outward into the surrounding areas. Normal operating procedures. They are used by operators to direct actions for plant maneuvering, system operation, for example, swapping trains, and component operation under what I'll call normal conditions or non-emergency or abnormal conditions. They are frequently referenced by alarm response procedures, abnormal operating procedures, EOPs, even the severe accident management guidelines or the extreme damage mitigation guidelines reference normal operating procedures for system manipulation, system reconfiguration. Examples of normal operating procedures include the OPL1, which is plant heat up from hot shutdown to hot standby, the OPI2I, or 2-1 containment spray system to make it available, and the OP Bravo 1 Charlie 1, which is a 4% boric acid system, alignment checklist, and flow path change instructions. So those are the procedures that the operators would refer to during normal operations to reconfigure the plant or reconfigure systems in the plant. I understand you're on batteries now. Okay, well, I believe you got a hard copy. If you'd like to continue, we can continue, or we
yes,
can...
Yes, let's keep going.
Okay. All right. The next category of procedures are enunciated response procedures. These procedures direct operator action to be taken in response to plant enunciators, the alarms in the control room, for example, that indicate potentially off-normal conditions or condensate polishing system operation. The other one, and this is to show the tie between an alarm response procedure and potentially an emergency operating procedure, is ARPK-0118, which is containment spray actuation. If you do have a containment spray actuation, this alarm would enunciate in the control room. The procedure would direct operators to EOP-0, which is reactor tripper safety injection, and to trip the reactor coolant pumps within 5 minutes if an actual containment high pressure exists. So enunciated response procedures that get the operators moving in the direction of managing what are hopefully upset but not emergency conditions.
Bill?
Sir?
Could you also, there in the control room, there are enunciators that would register alarms for high and low water level in the spent fuel pool.
Correct.
And just to confirm, there's procedures then that would be followed. What type of actions are taken if you have that sort of enunciator? That would be directly relevant to the question of assuring that you have inventory in the spent fuel pool.
Correct. Those procedures would direct dispatching somebody to the spent fuel pool to determine what conditions existed in the spent fuel pool, typically. They would have them go out and visually look at the spent fuel pool, locally check the level indication in the spent fuel pool. And they would also direct, there's actually an abnormal procedure on spent fuel pool as well that has various drain paths checked. It would direct refilling the pool if the inventory was low, those kinds of things. An enunciator is an alarm. Have you been in the simulator at the applicant?
I can't remember.
Okay. Above the control boards, there are panels with individual tiles with lights. Those lights will alarm, or they will come on. They will flash, and you'll hear an audible alarm. I'm sorry. Above the control boards, there are I'll call them enunciator tiles. That they're labeled, right? And if a certain abnormal condition develops, one of those enunciators will illuminate. It will call the operator's attention to the off-normal condition so that action can be taken. We're back. Abnormal operating procedures. Abnormal operating procedures direct operator actions in response to off-normal conditions or equipment response. These are regularly exercised in the simulator during both training and examinations. They refer to normal operating procedures, abnormal operating procedures, or the emergency operating procedures. There are two examples that are cited up there. One is AP30, which is main generator malfunction, which describes symptoms of and actions required. Next. Emergency operating procedures. The emergency operating procedures direct operator actions to be taken in response to an actual or potential plant emergency response. Again, these are regularly exercised in the simulator with operator training and examinations. They're entered upon receipt of indication of the need for a reactor trip or safety injection, or upon a loss of all vital AC power. They are symptom-based procedures. They do not require the operator to diagnose what problem is being experienced, simply to diagnose that there's a need for a reactor trip or safety injection or loss of off-site power, or loss of AC power, or there is a need for and the function has not occurred. These procedures are prepared using Westinghouse Owner Group guidelines based on principally upon TMI lessons learned. There's extensive verification and validation requirements associated with these procedures. Changes are not made lightly to these procedures. As I indicated, they're extensively trained on and exercised in the simulator. I've cited three examples there, and there'll be more. EOP0 is the reactor trip or safety injection procedure. That's basically one of the most common entry point into the network of emergency operating procedures. Going through that procedure, it will allow you to determine where you need to go next. So, for example, if you had a safety injection because of a loss of reactor coolant, you would enter the procedures at E0, step through the procedures, and they will logically take you to E1, which is the response to a loss of reactor coolant. EOP ECA00 is the loss of all vital AC power. That is basically the station blackout procedure, and it prescribes actions for removing decay heat, cooling the plant down, depressurizing it, and reducing loads on the DC vital power system. Other EOPs, we talked about EOP ECA00, EOP2, which is the faulted steam generator isolation, and EOP-E3, which is steam generator tube rupture. Under each one of these procedures, there is a series of more granular procedures that are driven by specific plant conditions or specific indications of problems or simultaneous problems. These are the high-level EOPs.
Is there an equivalent loss of all vital DC power procedure?
ECA-00 is loss of all vital AC power.
DC.
Oh, DC. There's not an EOP for that. There are abnormal operating procedures or casualty procedures for loss of DC power.
Okay, thank you.
The next grouping of procedures are called functional recovery guidelines. These are really an offshoot of the emergency operating procedures. They supplement the emergency control processes as the rest of the EOPs. The EOPs will either direct you to enter the functional recovery guidelines, or you'll monitor critical safety function status trees, and when you detect a critical safety function condition deteriorating, that becomes a priority for operator action. Examples include the FRS-1, which is response to basically an anticipated transient without scram. It's a failure to trip. FRC-1, which is inadequate core cooling. Response to secondary heat sink, as you can see there. If we go on to the next page, please.
Well, tell me, when you had ATWs, what do you do?
When you have a failure to trip, the actions are pretty prescriptive. You manually trip the reactor, you trip the turbine, you initiate auxiliary feed water, you begin manual rod insertion, and you begin emergency boration. And you've got 30 seconds to accomplish all of that,
right.
Thereabouts.
If manually doesn't trip, what do you do?
Well, all the actions that I prescribed. In the case of Diablo Canyon, there's one additional action. You can de-energize the electrical bus that provides power to the rod drive MG sets that would hopefully interrupt and allow the rods to drop. Not all plants can do that because some other plants have vital equipment that is supplied by the bus.
Right. So for Diablo, the operator knows exactly what to do. It doesn't trip on an anticipated transient. You manually trip it. It doesn't manually trip. You go de-energize that bus. If that bus doesn't get de-energized, that gets,
If you de-energize that bus, you remove the electrical power, eventually the ride drive MG sets will coast on and the control rods will drop. But in parallel with that, you're emergency injecting boron and you are manually inserting the control rods.
Now, I'm sure you're well aware of there has been a significant operating experience reported by Westinghouse way back 20, 30 years ago. Somebody used the wrong lubricant on the buses, and all of them, when de-energized, did not move.
I'm not familiar with that operating experience.
That's before your time, I guess.
Well, there's not much.
You're too young.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks. The functional recovery guidelines do provide direction under extremist conditions. Yes?
It's my understanding that you can't. You're not supposed to enter a functional recovery unless you're already in an EOP that then you find it necessary to go to functional recovery. And then when you're out of functional recovery, you go back to the EOP.
That's correct. So, for example, if you experience a transient without a scram, right. the sequence is you enter E0 because you've got the conditions warranted for treatment guidelines were generated as an industry initiative following the accident at Three Mile Island. They provide actions to respond to an event where the reactor is believed to be damaged. Typically, you would enter them when core exit thermocouples exceed 1,200 degrees as a directed entry from the emergency operating procedures. They are guidelines. They are not detailed prescriptive procedures. They were prepared using Westinghouse owner group guidelines. It is a 5054X condition. Command and control transitions, in this case, from operations to the emergency response organization and the technical support center. The technical support center will evaluate the guidelines while the operators continue to recycle in the EOPs, and they will provide direction to the operations staff on actions to be taken to mitigate the conditions as they are encountered. There is a flow chart associated with the severe accident management guidelines that prioritize the activities that need to be taken. I've listed some of the severe accident management guidelines up there. SACR G1, which is the first one, is implemented by the control room following identification of the need to enter the severe accident management guidelines. It remains in effect until the technical support center is manned. Then there's a procedure, SACR G2, which causes the control room to hand off to the technical support center. Then the technical support center will select the appropriate guideline to be implemented based upon conditions in the plant and will direct actions to implement the guides from that document. So, for example, SAG1, inject water into the steam generators, provides guidance to identify available steam generator injection paths, means of depressurizing the steam generators, and it goes through a decision-making process to ask and answer the question, should we really supply water to the steam generators? Or, for example, do we have a hot, dry steam generator where admission of water could cause the steam generator tubes to fail? So it's a series of high-level guidance like that in each one of these. SAG7 is reduced containment hydrogen, which provides direction to prevent containment hydrogen concentration from accumulating by either using hydrogen recombiners or using steam to inert containment and prevent a hydrogen explosion. So these provide alternate means of accomplishing or restoring a safety function and limiting damage. The other CMGs are listed here, SACR G2, which I mentioned, which is control room guideline for transients after the TSC is functional. Guidance on depressurizing the reactor coolant system, injecting into the reactor coolant system, injecting into the containment, reducing fission product releases through such things as spraying, control of containment conditions, flooding containment, mitigating fission product releases, and you can see the remainder that are up there. But they cover a wide range of conditions likely to be encountered under severe accidents or things that would mitigate the extent of a severe accident. The
Bill, could you discuss just a little bit in greater depth why these are called guidelines as opposed to being procedures?
They are not prescriptive procedures, right? What they do is they look at available resources in the condition of the plant, and they provide general direction to if you've got a high-pressure source of feed water injection available and your steam generator pressure is not excessive and you do not have a dried-out steam generator, it will tell you use that source of high-pressure feed water injection to inject water into the available steam generators. And there's not a lot of prescriptive direction beyond that level of direction. It will have you select a source, select a flow path, and make sure that the conditions are satisfied and that it's safe to do. So it's not like go open FCV 510, start the turbine-driven auxiliary feed water pump. It's not that level of detail in those procedures.
It also has such things as if there are two ways to accomplish something, it'll say generally this way is preferred. It's not prescriptive.
It is not prescriptive.
And it will provide the reasons why that's so, but leave it up to the people there to figure out whether or not that applicability is or isn't. But it's been thought through in advance, so they don't have to think it through.
They are more strategies than they are procedures.
Yeah, that was along the lines I was thinking. Yeah.
For example, the emergency operating procedures, and you step through the emergency operating procedures, the Westinghouse emergency operating procedures are the ones that I'm familiar with, right? It's read a step, do a step, assess whether or not it was successful. If you didn't get the desired outcome, you go to the response not observed column. You take those actions, then you go back into the left-hand column. You read the step. You perform it exactly as written. I mean, there's not a lot of options that are available, and you're not encouraged to take options when you're in those procedures. They're symptomatic, highly structured, designed to take you to a successful endpoint. The severe accident management guidelines have you take a step back and say, what conditions do I have? What resources do I have? And how can I deploy those resources to mitigate the consequences of the condition that I've identified?
Yeah. Is it possible to get into a space where you might find yourself referring to both? Is that possible? Or you could be doing something procedurally, but hitting a stage where you need to get more into a guideline type, you know what I mean?
Is it possible? Yes. In my personal experience elsewhere, when we did exercise these in the simulator, if I was, for example, in the simulator as a control room operator, we would take direction from the technical support center. We would implement the directions they gave us. We would continue to monitor plant conditions as specified in the emergency operating procedures to look for changing plant conditions. There would be dialogue back and forth regarding the appropriateness of what action to be taken.
See, it's my understanding that you got into this because the core is already starting to get damaged. You're in 50-54X.
Correct.
So you're, in a sense, excused from rigorously following those, but you might find a situation, the judgment of the staff, where following one of them is the right thing to do, and, of course, they would.
That capability always exists under 50-54X. I'm speaking from personal history, which is a bit dated, so forgive me, but basically there would be consultation between the TSC and the control room before action was taken in accordance with the EOP, because that may be contrary to what the TSC is trying to accomplish. It may be absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But there, that dialogue can occur, and there is flexibility.
Thank you.
A question that arises out of experience at Fukushima, and I'm curious how this would work. If one has station blackout, you'd be in a procedure space. There's procedures for responding to station blackout.
That's correct.
Correct. It would seem to me to be prudent, because under station blackout, you're reliant on a single steam-driven turbine to provide water injection, and you're, of course, a part of the procedure is to be working to restore AC power so
right.
that you could restore ultimate heat sink and other capabilities. But it would seem to be prudent to also begin to pre-stage some of the portable equipment in case you did not have electrical power and you would have a failure of the steam-driven pumps. And I'm curious, is there a way that you can get from the station blackout procedure into at least initiating some of the actions that are covered under the extreme damage mitigation guidelines for using portable equipment?
There are not clear ties, at least that I'm aware of, between the EOPs and the EDMGs. In other words, it's not a point where it says if you haven't restored power within 15 minutes, begin deploying X, Y, or Z. I'm not aware that there's any provisions in the EOPs currently for that.
In your judgment, is that absence a good thing, the lack of prescriptive guidance? In other words, is the leeway afforded to the crew at that stage a good thing? Or
the appropriate
so?
Thing to do if you're still in the EOP space is stay in the EOP space, because those EOPs are structured to take you to a safe place,
right?
If the conditions deteriorate for whatever reason beyond that, that's when you're going to find yourself in SAMG space. Remember that the EDMGs, and we haven't really talked about
the I'd prefer not to get
origin.
Into SAMG space,
well,
which is why I'd like to get into EDM space before getting into SAMG space.
Well, the EDMGs were written with a very specific scenario in mind.
I understand,
a large
yes.
fire explosion, right? And so the applicability of some of those strategies under conditions that took you into the EOPs may or may not be appropriate, right? It would have to be evaluated. Now, does that preclude the emergency operating facility or the technical support center from monitoring what's going on in the plant and going, I've got EDMGs, I've got CMGs, let's start thinking our way through, let's start posturing.
Yeah.
There's nothing that prohibits that. But before you hook up a temporary pump to a system, before you start operating equipment in a fashion driven by an EDMG or CMG, you need to make sure that the conditions warrant the declaration of the 5054X, right? Because that's the direction that you're heading.
Yeah. Right? This is, I think, something that in retrospect will merits review. And since you'll be leading this effort, and of course industry wide, it's also important. Clearly, any set of events, initiating events that would leave you in a protracted station blackout, has to involve some additional things that would, you know, and likely some additional damage to the plant or other things. And so it would be very surprising to me that one wouldn't, just as a part of the response, be looking at EDMG capabilities and potentially taking those actions. But it would be nice, actually, I think, to say that if you're in station blackout, you should be preparing for the potential need to implement EDMGs and assure yourself that you could do so in a timely way. Because in the end, the EDMGs take time to implement, and initiating the actions in a timely way is a critical element of having those EDMGs be effective.
I don't disagree with you.
No.
Stated another way, to avoid the double negative, I do agree with you. Again, recognize that the EDMGs have a very specific scenario or set of plant conditions in mind, and the EDMGs presume that you've experienced extreme damage to the plant. The EOPs do not.
right? And one doesn't envision getting to the other clearly. Clearly, that's an opportunity for improvement going forward. Clearly, it's an initiative that I think has been identified. We talked a little bit about that last night in the Way Forward document and one of the goals that have been established in that Way Forward document that's sponsored by NEIF, the INPO, in the industry, that there is need for assuring that these packages of procedures or this architecture fits together well and has the appropriate transitions to respond to a potentially severe accident, perhaps better than we have today.
I agree. And the, again, going back and looking at the progression of the accident at Fukushima, the delays in implementing the same types of actions that the EDMGs have prepared plants for in the United States was a problem. And I think the main thing we want to do is to assure ourselves that these actions would occur in a timely way if needed, whatever the initiating scenario might be.
The advantage that we have today, but it's not an optimal advantage, is we've thought out a lot of these strategies in response to extremis conditions in the plant, and so we can reach out and touch those strategies. It perhaps isn't as clear the circumstances exactly under which you would do that.
No, it's unambiguous that the level of preparation here in the United States is substantially better than where the Japanese were when they were faced with the damage from the tsunami that occurred. That's clear because the B-5B capabilities would have been directly relevant and helpful in mitigating the problems that they have. But it doesn't leave us with absolute confidence that in the United States those actions would indeed have occurred rapidly enough to have prevented substantive damage to fuel, release of hydrogen, and further progression of the accident.
And there is work that needs to be done in that regard.
But on the other hand, given my experience working with operators and understanding how they think about their responsibilities, I would have been very surprised to have not seen actions taken to start to deploy these capabilities if they had been faced with a similar situation. But you can't prove that that's the case.
I understand. And we're in agreement. The EDMGs, Extreme Damage Mitigation Guidelines, to be clear for everybody on what we're talking about here, were really generated in response to an NRC initiative in the post 9/11 environment. They were based upon the presumption that a nuclear power plant could suffer a loss of large areas of the plant in response to a fire or an explosion, and they were written to take advantage of available resources as supplemented by temporary equipment that would provide strategies that would mitigate the consequences of a large fire or explosion. The presumption was that you've already had the damaging event for these procedures. They are implemented by the ERO, not unlike the CMGs. You are in 50-54 X-ray space. And they do provide tools that can be used to help mitigate events, including such things as an alternate means of spent fuel pool cooling, excessive spent fuel pool leakage, decay removal using the steam generators with limited equipment availability, again, RCS release mitigation strategies, alternate sources of makeup water. We talked earlier about guidance on starting a diesel generator without DC power. That is one of these extreme damage mitigation guidelines.
Just to be very clear, that the responsibility and authority to mitigate, to take these actions rests in the control room with the operators.
It's been transferred, but remember that in order to get there, the operators have to agree.
But it's still on site. It's local.
It is on site. That is correct.
It's local.
But it's been transferred from control room to the technical center.
There's guidance for water usage from the raw water reservoirs and so forth. I'm not going to go through the remainder of the list if we could go on to the next slide.
Moving along through these
Again, they're implemented only if the control of the plant cannot be established from the control room or the hot shutdown panel. That's condition number one. Right. Condition number two is that you've experienced damage to the spent fuel pool that results in leakage greater than the capability of normal makeup.
Right.
There are some assumptions with the current EDMGs, and these are important assumptions because these are assumptions that going forward I believe we're going to have to challenge to make these more effective tools. Mm-hmm. It assumes a loss of all electrical power but only to one unit at a multi-unit station. Okay. Mm-hmm. The turbine-driven aux feed water pump is assumed to have been started within approximately 30 minutes following the event. Only one guideline is utilized at a time. Only one unit is damaged enough to require implementation, right, which is a situation that was different in Japan. And it provides mitigation strategies principally for the first 24 hours following the event, recognizing that hopefully you've done something to stabilize at that condition, you've got a better assessment of what's going on, and you're better prepared to make perhaps more informed decisions.
Now, industry-wide, this set of assumptions is going to be revisited because, and I can say, obviously, there are situations we can envision in which you would want to be entering these or using them for guidance that don't necessarily meet all these dots.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Okay.
And so, therefore, in the next, I don't mind my saying, in the next few months or year or so, in the industry together is going to be thinking through which adaptations of these we should be bringing in so we can cope with other things that don't exactly meet these assumptions.
Again,
things like the Fukushima event, which wouldn't.
Precisely. But again, recognize that these are assumptions that were used to construct these documents.
Right. And they, right? And they had a different thing in mind. There was a different initiating event.
Precisely. But if you're in 5054X space, right, you have latitude to do things that perhaps are a little bit different than these assumptions. It has to be a thoughtful application to make sure that you're not creating a problem larger than the one you're trying to solve. Yeah. But, for example, I mean, you have information available in these EDMGs that under extremis conditions would allow you to address a spent fuel pool situation while perhaps you were off doing something else with the remainder of the plant.
Mm-hmm. So, and perhaps eventually be, I mean, this procedure would be escalated to a loss of complete power to two units.
There's nothing that would prohibit me from applying the instructions in these EDMGs to multiple units.
But
the assumption was written for one unit.
But you've got to think through whether or not doing that is or isn't applicable.
That's right.
Right. Because, you know, well, within this assumption, you can always tap power from the other units.
Because these were carefully thought through to match those assumptions, mm-hmm. and they may or may not match some other condition.
That's correct.
That's a lot of times they will, but not necessarily.
And there's a lot of flexibility in these instructions. But that's why, that's why they're called guidelines and not procedures, right? They're not prescriptive.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
You can see the population of EDMGs in the next slide or two. There's internal and external spent fuel pool makeup. The difference is on the internal, we would rely on the existing fire water system and run hoses. The external, we would place a fire truck, a fire pumper, and take water out of the header and run hose. Spent fuel pool cooling via spray, which is using a fire truck and a crane with a nozzle attached to it to spray through an opening in the fuel handling building. Leakage control strategies, which are damage control procedures for patching holes in the tank, making up water to the RWST condensate storage tank, depressurizing the steam generators, manual operation to control steam generator water level. We talked earlier about doing that, the capabilities in a PWR, those are the directions that would provide that. Use of a fire engine to supply water to the steam generators. Unfortunately, I didn't push the enter button on the next one. Containment flooding with a portable pump, venting containment, starting a diesel without DC power, portable sprays, and the last one is just an admin procedure. It's an annual equipment inventory. But those procedures offer a wide variety of strategies that can be employed under a variety of circumstances. But obviously, they're intended to be used under extremis conditions.
Quick point of clarification. In here, you write extensive damage, and I've also heard people say extreme damage. It is extensive?
I believe it's extreme.
Extreme. Okay. I just want to make sure
I'll have to go back and validate.
Maybe to confirm so that we're using what the same terminology as NRC would use for extreme.
I'll validate that. Okay. It'll send me a little note to remind me to do that. I'll get back to you on that. Casualty procedures are the last category of procedure. Oh, actually, they're not. There's one other beyond the casualty procedures. The casualty procedures address actions in response to external events or fires. We've got a procedure that governs broadly the actions to be taken in response to an earthquake, including damage assessment and you know whether or not the right things have been done to the plant. Response to a tsunami warning, which by and large involves moving people to higher ground and preparing mm-hmm. for a challenge to the intake structure. For example, during the following the tsunami at Fukushima, there was a tsunami warning here, and we did evacuate our intake structure and took some precautions to assure that equipment and people were protected, to make sure that the rooms were watertight and so forth. CPM 6 deals with fire and how to deal with fires. CPM 12, I alluded to this a little bit last night, a stranded plant. That's if you lose normal access to the plant via the roadways and the kind of actions that you need to take and precautions you need to take. And then there's a series of procedures, CPM 15, Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, that specifically deal with security threats of varying levels of magnitude that direct action on how to respond to those. These procedures do provide direction to operations and other organizations, including the Emergency Response Organization, to manage the indicated conditions. For example, in the case of the response to the tsunami warning, that was principally actions that were driven by operations because the ERO was not staffed. But if the ERO had been staffed, there could be additional actions that would be appropriate. And in general, they're used in parallel to other procedures for mitigating the event in question. And then the last group of procedures is the emergency plan implementing procedures. They're prepared for implementing the emergency plan, which is probably self-explanatory. But they do focus on the actions to protect the health and safety of the public during a declared emergency. And when I say protect the health and safety of the public, clearly all of our procedures do that. But these are generally procedures that are outward-looking to interface with local government agencies, with the NRC, with other entities to assure that we're monitoring the environment. We're doing things like doing dose projections. And we're assessing the need for things like potassium iodide. We're looking at whether or not we need to evacuate or shelter in place portions of the population. They do include procedures for communication with the public. We've got a joint information center that is our principal media outlet and communication vehicle with the public. We also have backup emergency facilities. Both of these areas were problematic during the Fukushima event. I've enumerated the procedures here. EPG-1 is emergency classification, emergency plan activation. That starts in the control room. But as the ERO is staffed, the responsibilities are passed out to the other emergency response facilities. There's an interim emergency response organization, which again is the organization that's put in place in the control room. But a large part of what these emergency plan implementing procedures do is relieve the control room of the responsibility of dealing with the emergency plan so that they can focus on dealing with the plant while other people deal with the emergency plan and the surrounding areas and the actions needed, again, to protect the health and safety of the public beyond those just to mitigate the accident. Emergency notifications, instructions for field monitoring teams, release rate calculations. Just to pick a couple of the others, emergency offsite dose calculations, core damage assessment, release of airborne radioactive materials, facility operation, and backup emergency response facilities. I'm not going to read the others. You can see what those are. So the emergency organization, there's extensive resources that operate collaboratively in an emergency. For PG&E, you've got the control room staff. Initially, they will be the emergency response organization until the emergency response organization is activated. And when that happens, the control room will be afforded the opportunity to focus on the plant, while the ERO focuses on more outward-looking or plant support. The technical support center, we talked about their implementation of the severe accident management guidelines. They are there in a technical support function for the control room and to provide assistance to the plant. The Operations Support Center is resources available for maintenance-type activities or damage control-type activities. The Emergency Operations Facility is principally the interface with external organizations between the plant, the TSC, and the external organizations, assuring the free flow of communications. Diablo Canyon is unique in my experience in the nuclear industry by having a unified dose assessment center. Where you have people working cooperatively from the local government authorities along with the Diablo Canyon people to arrive at perhaps some mutually agreeable protective action recommendations, although there is an element of independence that's preserved. I've not seen that level of cooperation in the other plants that I've worked at any place in the United States. So that's a strength in the local community. The Joint Information Center, obviously, for PG&E. Extensive resources available in the county, the state of California, and in a delayed fashion, both the NRC and FEMA. So there's a lot of organizations who rally around upset conditions or potentially upset conditions at Diablo Canyon. So, conclusions. Diablo Canyon's got an extensive network of procedures for dealing with a wide variety of plant conditions from normal operation to beyond design basis events. Are there opportunities going forward to make those procedures capable of better handling some of the things we saw at Japan? The answer to that question is yes. That's pretty clear. We need to do that. There's going to be regulatory mandates to do that, I'm confident.
And industry mandates.
And industry mandates, yes. The emergency preparedness procedures are in place, including those for prompt and complete communication with the public and activation of backup emergency response facilities as necessary. The responsibilities for implementing these procedures are clearly delineated in terms of what the operator is expected to do, what the ERO is expected to do, what the state and county are expected to do. So there is a good infrastructure. We exercise those procedures regularly in the form of not only simulator training but emergency response organization drills to identify opportunities for improvement and to maintain proficiency. Procedures are in place both procedurally and in the regulatory framework to assure decisions necessary to protect the health and safety of the public can and will be taken locally and expeditiously by technically qualified people. And this is a key lesson learned, I think, from Fukushima, where that infrastructure was not in place, that architecture was not in place, or at least not in place as effectively as I believe it to be here.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Furman?
One thing I didn't hear you address is control room habitability upon loss of station AC and or DC power.
It would be challenged. We would lose the control room HVAC system, assuming a station blackout. That's what you're talking about. We would lose the control room HVAC system. There are some emergency lighting in there, but it is of limited capability. While it would not necessarily be uninhabitable, it would not be an environmentally friendly environment. It would be a difficult place to work. There's just no two ways around that.
You would have lighting.
There would be some emergency lighting in there. That's correct.
Just the ventilation system wouldn't be.
Well, you would not have full control room lighting because remember that lighting is typically driven off of AC. There is some backup to that for some period of time, but unless you were able to charge the batteries or replace them, you likely will be operating with flashlights and battle lanterns after some period of time.
Mm-hmm. Quick follow-on. What about the emergency shutdown panels? Is the environment there likely to be more hospitable?
I think not. I don't know that for a fact. Under equivalent conditions, I don't think it would be much more hospitable. I don't, but again, I've not been there, so I can't speak to that.
As a matter of fact, that place in some facility is difficult to find.
Yeah, but it's okay here.
Yeah. But again, you're operating without any...
It's okay.
Any lighting or ventilation system, so it's going to be an uncomfortable.
It's going to be temporary lighting.
Yeah. It's going to be temporary. Yeah.
It was. I had the opportunity to tour the Millstone Unit 1 about 3 weeks after Fukushima, and it was very interesting because the lack of power meant that the operators were making manual readings of pressure indication, for example, with flashlights. And it was pretty impressive to think about the dedication and effort that those operators put into that work, given how challenging the conditions were after the earthquake.
And I'm confident that the operators at Diablo Canyon would show the same professionalism and the same dedication.
My expectation is exactly the same.
Any other questions from here?
All right. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions from the public? Please give us your name and where you're from.
Yes, Tom Schumann from San Luis Obispo.
Oh, speak it into the mic. We're doing this because it's being streamed.
Okay. Couple of questions. How often do the technicians practice their emergency operating procedures?
He can answer it, but I'll start by saying that they spend one out of every five shifts in training at the simulator,
which is a lot. So a typical technician...
No, a control room operator.
Operator. He would go through a test every five shifts?
No. Every 5 weeks,
they spend a week at the simulator instead of doing their work.
Oh, okay.
And during that week, they do all sorts of training.
Okay. And at, when they do the simulator, do they have do they test against random, unexpected problems?
Yes, although some of it is training on things they know is coming, and sometimes they spring something on them.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, some combination of that, of course. Any other questions from the public?
I'm Sherry Lewis from San Luis Obispo. I was a little puzzled by the lighting situation in the control room. It sounds like because the control room is such an important place that there ought to be some kind of backup lighting that would make things a lot better.
There is, but again, it's battery backup. It's not going to operate indefinitely absent charging the batteries or restoring some power.
So when you talked about using flashlights and things like that, that's when the backup lighting had failed?
Well, that was in Fukushima, and that was long after that had failed, correct?
No, I thought he was saying, I thought he was describing here.
If we could not restore power for a protracted period of time, the potential exists for getting there. I'm not going to discount that.
Right.
Right.
Okay. The other question I had was about resupply, I guess it's makeup water for the spent fuel pools. You referred to the fact that there's water on site, there's the storage water and things like that. It was my understanding that the spent fuel pools use so much water that you don't have enough on site to resupply all the water, or at least continuously.
Oh, I don't think that could be right. They have 2.5 million gallons up in that, up above there that we saw on the tour today. And although it takes time to plumb that in, there is a lot of time before you get in trouble with the spent fuel pools. I don't think it's so that there isn't enough water on the site, but perhaps PG&E can.
Like you said, there's 2.5 million gallons of water in that reservoir, and there's actually, twice that, right?
And there's two of them.
And that water can be used in a variety of applications for decay removal in a spent fuel pool. I'm not sure I understand the part of the question about or the implication that there's going to be a rapid loss of water from the spent fuel pool.
There were a rapid loss of water from the spent fuel pool, how many millions of gallons are in the pool itself would have been when it's full?
I don't know. I don't know what the capacity is in terms of gallons.
But that's important, I would think, because you need to know that it can be filled up again.
Sure.
See, my understanding is that it would have to be circulating and filling, and that the reactor uses, maybe not just the spent fuel, but even the reactor itself, the reactor uses an awful lot of water every day.
But the reactors, in this scenario, there's been some upset condition, and the reactor shut down. I mean, the reactor isn't running.
You don't need water going through it if it's not running?
No, that's just the point. You need a lot less water when it's not running and it's shut down because the only heat that you have to worry about is what we call the decay heat. It's a few percent of the full power when it's running.
Right, okay.
When it's running, you have to have a lot of water. It comes from the ocean here to cool. But when it's not running, it's only a few percent, or after a week or so, it's down to a couple percent.
I see.
There's a lot less water necessary to cool a shutdown reactor than one that's running.
Okay, so then the question would be, I guess it's kind of obvious, that the resupplying water from the storage water is enough to cover the spent fuel pools if they should lose all their water.
Well, that's my understanding. I mean,
yeah, I guess I would first respond that just like at the Fukushima plants, those pools were designed for the seismic events, and as near as we can tell, they survived the seismic events. Likewise, ours are designed at an even higher ground shaking than what Fukushima's was. So number one, it would be difficult to project a scenario where you would have any kind of a gross loss of water out of spent fuel pool. But even if we did, we have substantially more, at least in Diablo's situation, a lot more water with the 5 million gallons of water on the hill that is just basically a gravity drain to be able to accommodate any makeup that we would need to.
So that would fill up the two spent fuel pools?
Right.
One then also, if it were necessary, could use water from the ocean for that purpose. Right. Filling up a spent fuel pool with ocean water would be a reasonable thing to do. And in that case,
you'd have
then,
to have pumps and all that to get
yeah.
it up there.
And so you would basically have a fire truck, for example,
right.
pump water from the intake area up into the, so one could use ocean water also, but it'd be quite unlikely to need to do that given the large amount of fresh water that's available in the pools and the fact that that can be fed just by gravity down to the plant.
Also, it's fair to say for anybody in the public that's here that doesn't know this, many, many of our nuclear plants don't have an on-site fire department. They rely on the city department that's right next door. And in fact, that's almost all of them, with arrangements, of course, and training, and the people that come from the off-site or the county or the city have to be trained about what to do with the reactor, and they all are. But Diablo has its own fire department, and the reason for that's obvious, because the road is too long to rely on the city or the county. There's too much time to be involved. So they have their own on-site fire department, which is unusual, but it's there, and they're trained. And those people would be closer to and more amenable to some of these very unusual emergency actions because they're actually part of PG&E's own reactor staff.
And a single fire truck would have enough power to pump up water from there?
Well, for the spent fuel pool, you'd think it would.
There would be no pressure in the – it's an open pool like a swimming pool, so you could just basically pump in. You won't have had to overcome from draining down from the gravity drains. It's just basically gravity down.
No, I'm talking about from the ocean.
Well, first you would go from the tanks that are around
right,
at the same levels.
Right, that I understand, yeah.
So you would utilize those first, and then you would go to the gravity drain. So you'd have a variety of sources before you'd have to go down to the ocean, as Pierre suggested. It would be many, many levels of layers, and that would be the last, and then you would have either portable pumps or the fire engine pumps. Either one would be capable of doing that.
Yeah, and you think the fire engine pump would be capable of lifting enough water from the ocean?
I think so. Yeah, that it's nice it's there because it's a last resort that a lot of people don't
right.
have, but it is there.
It's not good to have it be a last resort that doesn't work.
Of course. We worry about a lot of things, but I don't think that's something that we're concerned won't work. They have plenty enough capability, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that fair? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the PG&E people think so too. Okay, the meeting's just about to be called to a close, and before it is, I want to remind everybody about one thing. Yesterday, early in the meeting, we had a discussion about an open items list in which we decided that we would separate out a whole set of open items that were related to the Fukushima accident and its lessons learned and give them a separate category in our open items list just so that we would be able to keep track of them better, track them better, and collate them better with open actions and lessons learned from other things like the NRC, INPO, International, Japanese, so on. So we're going to do that. Furman took time overnight to develop a proposed categorization, but I don't think we have time to talk about it here. So we'll just, this is not a crucial thing, it's a piece of committee business. So we'll circulate that around and make sure that we're all happy with the way those open items are recategorized. And we'll adopt that as a recategorization of our open items list and use it henceforth. Okay? So we're going to do that offline, not in the meeting. It's not really a crucial item except a piece of a business for us. One last thing, and then we're going to adjourn, and that is that yesterday we scheduled a whole bunch of future site visits going out more than a year and public meetings and the like. And we're still awaiting the last confirmations on almost all of that, and I think that Pete can either give that to us now or in any event, you're going to circulate around by email. This goes out to and including the meeting that's a year hence. All right? Is there anything that we tentatively talked about you can't confirm?
I've already talked to Mr. Wellington about the two public meetings. We're good with those.
Okay, we are.
I don't know if he's had any luck with you know, venues and whatnot.
But the dates are okay.
As far as the dates that we talked about, we talked specifically about July and September. If we talked about August, I missed that. So I need to get a refresh on any August dates.
August this year.
Next year.
August of 2012.
Right, 2012.
Yes, okay.
I still have a question mark on that one. Everything else we discussed is okay.
Okay, and I remember that too. It seems to me that the exact dates in August of 2012 we're going to leave open and we'll settle them in October. It's still plenty of time
away.
That's
probably why I don't have them.
Right. Yeah. But all the rest, you're coming back to us saying, yes, you can confirm.
That's correct.
Right.
And what I'd like to ask what we've done in the past is write up a confirmation email, you know, on what you understand we're going to go. And we'll make sure
everybody sees it,
it all lines up.
Everybody sees it, and we're all nodding at once.
Right.
So it's to avoid an inadvertent miscommunication.
That's correct.
And then as soon as we have those dates, I propose that we ask our support staff to put those public meeting dates, for example, on the website so that even a year in advance, people in the public can see when our public meeting dates are. That's easy to do. Right, Ron?
I think they're on the website. What we'll do is change our October meeting to October 5 and 6.
Right.
And that will be at the Embassy Suites.
But we've now set in advance the one for
next June. That's the only new one.
The others have been there.
Yep.
And the one
February.
For next June we'll add. So that people in the public can see a year in advance where we're headed.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so without further ado, I'm looking to get the number right. I'm going to adjourn the 63rd public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Okay, thanks.